He reminded me yesterday that I've forgotten one argument. We had counted five arguments, no? Epistemological, dialectical, historical, quintessential metaphysical argument, and causal argument. One argument was missing. Anybody remembers it? Good, analogical argument, good. Now, you have to find out for me in which paragraph analogical argument has been placed. It is in the third paragraph. You have found it? Oh, good, excellent. In the fourth paragraph, as there, so here. As there, so here. Twice that phrase comes, isn't it? As there, so here. As there, so here. Got it? So the analogy is that just as there, so here. Just as there, so here. That's the analogy. Now we come to the last paragraph. You know, I'm taking so much time with the first chapter because if you are well grounded in the first chapter, you become well grounded in the whole book. Because the first chapter is kind of a summary of the whole book. So if you know the first chapter very well, you can say to yourself that you know now the basic argument of the whole book. So I'm spending so much time, almost how many lectures you have given to them? Nearly 10 lectures, no, by now. So it is worth doing it. So even this last paragraph, even if it takes time, don't worry. We shall go slowly. Thus the eternal paradox and eternal truth of a divine life in an animal body, an immortal aspiration or reality inhabiting a mortal tenement, a single and universal consciousness representing itself in limited minds and divided egos, a transcendent, indefinable, timeless and spaceless being who alone renders time and space and cosmos possible. And in all these, the higher truth realizable by the lower term justify themselves to the deliberate reason as well as to the persistent instinct or intuition of mankind. It's a long sentence. We have to find out what exactly is the main verb in this. If you can find out the verb, the main verb of this whole sentence, good. Justify. This is the main word. Sri Aurobindo has made the full argument by now. And he now concludes. This is a concluding paragraph. Having employed all arguments, epistemological, historical, dialectical, quintessential metaphysical, causal, analogical, all arguments put together. Now the conclusion is that something is justified. Namely, mankind's aspiration for God, light, freedom, immortality. This aspiration is justified rationally, intellectually. It is not merely a matter of faith. It is a matter which you can intellectually justify and prove to yourself. It will be irrational not to accept this aspiration. It would be rational to accept this aspiration. And the main point is, the lower term and the higher term. In fact, the very beginning of the argument starts with contradiction. What is low contradicts what is high. This is the basic contradiction. Now, Sri Aurobindo has proved that instead of being in a state of contradiction, the lower is going to embody the higher. So there is basically no contradiction. The lower is able to embody the higher. This can happen only if there is no contradiction between the two. If the lower can receive the higher, it can be only if in the lower there is a possibility of absorbing the higher. And for absorbing you should have corresponding terms. In the lower there is normally the experience of pain. In all our lower life as we are living, there is pain. In the higher there is bliss. Now if pain and bliss are really contradictory of each other, then the lower can never absorb the higher. If they are contradictory of each other. But if pain itself is a limited ananda, limited bliss, is itself a form of bliss. If pain itself is a form of bliss, not opposed to bliss, then you can convert this pain into bliss. This is the argument. Pleasure, for example, is in a sense opposed to bliss. Just as pain is opposed to bliss, similarly pleasure also is opposed to bliss. Because the pleasure that we have is a kind of an ephemeral, flimsy kind of a sensation which happens for a little while and then goes away. And that pleasure has nothing comparable to that bliss. Therefore, even pleasure is opposed to that bliss. But if pleasure also is only a limited bliss, then in that limited thing, when it expands, it becomes bliss. So what was seen to be contradictory is not really contradictory. It is simply a limited form of the higher. Therefore, it is an eternal paradox. Paradox because how can bliss become pain? How can bliss become pleasure? How can bliss become indifference? Because these are the only three experiences we have. Indifference, pleasure and pain. So how can these three, which are seemingly opposite of bliss, how can these three be turned into bliss? They can be turned into bliss because they are limited forms. When you limit ananda, and then that limitation takes these three forms, pleasure, pain, indifference. In fact, there is a full chapter, chapter number 12 in this book, where Sri Aurobindo will explain how ananda, the bliss, has become pleasure, pain and indifference by limitation. So they are not contradictory of each other, they are only paradoxical of each other. You know, there is a difference between opposition and paradox. A paradox is where two opposites seem to be apparently opposite, but not really. I am hastening slowly. If I speak this sentence, I am hastening slowly. It's a paradox. Charmingly ugly. There are experiences, experience of ugliness, but very charming, charmingly ugly. It's paradox, but not really paradox, because in ugliness also there is a charm. I am tragically happy. I am tragically happy. It's a paradox. A tragedy occurs and you feel happy. Tragedy normally creates a lot of sorrow, but there are experiences where you become tragically happy. There was an experience. If you see the drama called Hamlet, I don't know if you know the story of Hamlet, do you? You know the story of Hamlet? If you see the drama of Hamlet, the story as it unfolds before you, if you are somebody staging the whole drama of Hamlet, the story begins with a dreadful night. Already the scene, the very first scene of Hamlet, gives you a kind of an atmosphere of dread. Everything is hush. Not a mouse stirring, as he says in the very beginning. And then there appears a ghost of the father of Hamlet, who has just died. So the whole atmosphere is full of suspense. Something weird, something strange, dreadful, in something that is dark, a ghost appearing and calling Hamlet alone. He wants to communicate a message. Hamlet is drawn towards the ghost. And then the ghost reveals to Hamlet that he has been murdered. It's not an ordinary death. And that murder was committed by his brother and his wife. That is, his own wife and his own brother. A dreadful story. This is the starting point of the tragedy. Something horrible has happened, and now there is unfoldment of horrible events, one after the other. And if you examine the play, it's a series of murders which take place, one after the other. A series of deaths which occur. Polonius is murdered. Ophelia dies. And then several others. And towards the end, Laertes, the brother of Ophelia, is murdered. The king is murdered. The wife dies. Horatio is murdered. Hamlet goes. It's full of tragedy. When you see at the end, you feel comforted. The whole horrible thing has ended. Tragically happy. There is a release, as it were. Hamlet, who was tortured, but there is an end in which you feel the release of Hamlet from all kind of torture. It's an experience of tragic happiness. So whenever there is a real tragedy from another side, there is an angle of looking at every tragedy where you find a release. It gives its own experience. So there is not exact opposition between tragedy and happiness. It's a paradox.